I wrote over 500 songs, pick what you like. It ain't easy being me by day or night, but it's easy being free to recite what you like. Hip-hop is my inalienable right. When it comes to MC and KRS, is a whole different type. Now go get it right, did I flow, spit it tight. In a fight, I was the type to go get a pipe. Beep, 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 moving them back. Beep, that's the sound of an aluminum bat. But it seems they new to these facts, which means they new to the tracks, which means they do hold us back.
Real talk, real talk.
Hey, yo, Chris, man.
Yo.
I'm seeing a lot of movement in the industry right now. I'm seeing a lot of cats coming into the industry, but they got the wrong idea.
I hear what you're saying.
But for real, a lot of cats coming into it like, yo, what could the industry do for me? No. What could you bring to the industry? What could you bring new to the industry?
I hear you, Molly.
Man?
I hear you.
For real.
Like, watch this. Nothing new, nothing new. They're not saying nothing new, nothing new, nothing new. They're not saying nothing new. They run and run and run and run and run their lyrics through. But when you finish rhyming, you have not heard nothing new. Say this one dedicated to the one that run and rhyme. Time after time after time after time.
Street official, real talk.
All right, y'all, we back again. And you know, we're doing a special Black History Month podcast where I'm going and I'm getting folks that I truly respect and believe can actually teach not only you guys something, but I'm learning something every time I talk to them. You know, I've got something from Ice Cube now. We've gotten something from Dr. Cornel West. We expecting Jesse Jackson to come on board. And I'm going to tell you, we got the teacher on board today. And there's so many ways to describe him. I'm going to let him describe himself. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Yeah, what's up? This is KRS-One.
Now, y'all know we about to do some hot shit today. We about to... Hey, Chris, I'm serious, man. We about to do some hot things today, and I'm going to play nothing but a lot of boom bap on this show.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? We're going to balance out some hip-hop on this show. I'm going to let the teacher go ahead and speak on some things. And, sure. and the first thing I want to get into is I want to talk about Hip Hop Lives, which you know is a very historical record for those who don't know. Why don't you give us a little background on that?
Well, you know, Hip Hop Lives, which is my latest project out, we completed it in 2007. It's when I say we, it's a collaboration between myself and Molly Mall. And those that I guess don't know, I'll start with the don't knowers first. Molly Mall is what we call in hip hop a super producer. Most of the artists that we consider classics or legends, or most of the albums we consider classics, most of the artists that we consider legends, this guy, Molly Mall, has produced everyone. And when I say produced, not produced them when they were at their heyday or at their top. Molly Mall is the type of producer that originates. He trendsets. He starts groups. His lineup includes acts like Kool G Rap in the early days, like Kool G Rap's first album, Big Daddy Kane's first album, Biz Markie's first album, Roxanne Shanté, Eric B. and Rakim, LL Cool J, not his first album, but the comeback album for LL Cool J, Mama Said Knock You Out, that's Molly Mall. So first and foremost, you got to understand who we're working with. This guy is a talented producer and has been a staple in hip-hop since the beginning of sampled music, I should say. In fact, Molly Mall is credited with being the first producer to sample records, as a matter of fact, the absolute first. So as the story goes, they put out a record in 1985, actually starts in 85 with UTFO, putting out a record called Roxanne, Roxanne, to which Roxanne Shanté answers the record with Roxanne's Revenge, to which that sparked an entire slew of answer records, and the answer record era was kind of born right there. Molly Mall was the producer of Shanté, as we know, and was a key figure in the battle between Roxanne Shanté and UTFO. Molly Mall was the producer for Shanté. So the answer record scene blew up. 1986. Salt-N-Pepa answers Dougie Fresh. MC Shan answers LL Cool J, and I answer MC Shan. And in the midst of this answer record era, Sparky D answers Roxanne Shanté. Roxanne Shanté and MC Lyte actually gets into it. I guess it was about a year later, but they get into it, and so on. But it'll just answer record era. So I answer MC Shan's Queensbridge, where he says, "You love to hear the story again and again of how it all got started way back when. The monument is right in your face. Sit and listen for a while to the name of the place. The Bridge. The Bridge, the Bridge, the Bridge, the Bridge, Queensbridge." I responded with South Bronx, the South, South Bronx. Hip-hop did not start in Queensbridge. It started in the South Bronx. That was the argument. However, the argument was weak because the real issue was that Scott LaRock, my late DJ, and I were trying to get on. And the only way to break into the industry at that particular moment was to answer someone who was already hot. But your record had to be hot as well. You couldn't just answer a guy and expect to get on. It had to be a nice addition or part two or so on. Like Just Ice, he didn't answer Lottie Dottie, but he kind of did his version of Lottie Dottie, which was LaToya, which was his first record, LaToya, and that got him through the door. You got to understand the era of time, and I'm speaking to the ones that don't know or weren't part of this era of time. That's why I'm explaining it in this way. So I answer MC Shan, he with South Bronx, answers his record Queensbridge. I answer with South Bronx. He returns with a record called South Bronx, Kill That Noise. I respond with a record called The Bridge Is Over, where I get an opportunity to introduce hip-hop and reggae, the combination of hip-hop reggae. I had already heard Shinehead, a reggae artist, brilliant artist. Shinehead was already experimenting with reggae and hip-hop together and making a big splash on the streets. But he was Jamaican himself and didn't rhyme American in that sense. He would combine Jamaican bass lines with American drums, or black American drums, should I say rock drums. But he'd chant Jamaican patois on top. That was his style. That inspired me to battle Shan with what was the hottest style on the streets at the time. Shinehead wasn't doing anything new, although he was very innovative with it. He is the first one to do that, hip-hop, reggae combined. But everybody was doing it. So it was like an underground style on the street. So I kind of made that the platform. The bridge is over. The bridge is over. With a bye-bye. And started hitting cats with the Jamaican lingo back in 86. They didn't know what to do. And so the criticism started coming in. Well, you know, you're a successful rap group because you made two successful singles, but you're still an amateur because you don't have an album. And an amateur in the sense of how much we can get paid, what kind of gigs we can get, so on. We're still getting treated like the 12-inch crowd. There was a bunch of 12-inches out in 86. and we were part of that crowd, never to be part of a Fresh Fest tour or anything Houdini or Run DMC was doing. We weren't that legitimate yet. We just had two singles out, and they were both battle records. So magazines like Rap Masters and Word Up and Write On and Fresh and all of these, what was then called fanzine magazines, they were printing that Boogie Down Productions is only a battle group. It's not a real group. They don't put out songs. They don't write songs. They just battle other groups. And so I took kind of offense to that and wrote Criminal Minded, the album. And when it was done, it never came out in the stores when it first came out. not never, when it first came out, we sold it through UPS. It did come into stores. It wasn't distributed to the stores through normal channels. We sold it. I sold it on the street corner of 132nd Street in Millbrook. I was 132nd Street in Cypress Avenue in the Bronx. I sold pillows for $25 out on the street, big pillows for your couch or for bed or whatever, big pillows. And my album, Criminal Minded.
Sold
both of them right there on the corner. Now, the reason I bring this part up is because during all of this, say, from about 1980, 81 to about 86, 87, I was homeless. Even though I was making records, I was still living in the streets, riding the trains of New York, sleeping in Central Park and West 4th Street Park. So if you can imagine, I'm in this battle. Well, let me back up the tape a little bit and put a period on this. I'm homeless. So in 1985, I go to a shelter, 166th Street and Boston Road, shelter in the Bronx. And I'm there about 2 months in the shelter, and in walks a brand new social worker named Scott Sterling. And he became my social worker, and we suddenly realized that he was a DJ on the side and I was an MC. But he's the social worker, and I'm what is called a client. I'm in the shelter. And so in the shelter, he's the social worker, which has all authority and power in the shelter system. And me, I'm the client who has absolutely no power, in which I'm actually asking for a meal and clothes and shelter in that sense. My needs are being tended to in that sense. Two opposite sides of the spectrum. I'm a high school dropout. Scott Sterling, DJ Scott LaRock, has a four-year college degree from Vermont State University. Completely different. We link up and take a liking to each other, drawn really by each other's skills. I was impressed with the fact that he DJed at Broadway International, then called Broadway RT, Broadway Repertory Theater, which was on 145th Street and Broadway in Upper Manhattan. And Scott would DJ there and have the place rocking, like just bouncing with all crazy. It was just insane how he used to get the party going. And I was impressed with that. I was like, wow, if I ever had a DJ, man, it would be like him and this, that, and the other. Plus, I was on his guest list. I couldn't afford to get in the clubs. He put me on the guest list and gave me a drink ticket. And I go in, and I'm there on his behalf. So I was loyal to Scott and appreciative and highly respectful. But I was KRS, the MC. So he saw that. A few times we got into some MC battles, and he had nobody to turn to but me or be embarrassed. And, of course, I would demolish whole crews. whole crews would just fall out because Scott LaRock was my bread and butter and my friend on top of that. Imagine a social worker who takes you to get something to eat, buys you sneakers, and then tells you come to the club and hang out with him. You know, I'm like, nah, you're not dissing him. That's not happening. And so that started, in a way, Boogie Down Productions, and it kind of started us in, like, the battle scene in that sense. Every DJ had an MC that could battle or rock a party, and Scott didn't have that until, of course, I showed up. Scott LaRock is killed in August 1987, on the 26th of August, and trying to break up a fight, trying to mediate a conflict between D-Nice and another guy. And within that, Scott was shot and fatally wounded. And so he dies. And the press release is Boogie Down Productions is over. In fact, before when Scott was alive, we had went to California to get a deal with Warner Brothers Records. We met a guy named Benny Medina, and to try to get a deal with Warner Brothers Records, and we got the deal. Benny Medina gave us a deal, $275,000 signed to Warner Brothers. And when we got home, Scott was killed. And so I call Benny and say, yo, I'm ready to do the deal.
Right.
But the news was already out that Scott was killed and this and that. I said, I'm ready to do the deal. Benny said, quote, I was interested in a whole group. In a whole group. I was more interested in the whole group. I said, but Benny, I could do this, man. I'm telling you, I wrote all the songs. I can produce myself. He said, you know, Chris, I wish you luck. He was very cordial, very polite, very respectful, all of that. But the bottom line was the deal is off. And so another guy named Barry Weiss picked me up. But it just seems that in KRS's life, I can't say for anyone else, but for me, I'm a love-hate relationship with the African-American community, starting with the disappearance of my father, who I never knew. I was raised by a single parent, my mom's, and she was an orphan. Her mother died of tuberculosis, and she never knew her father. And so she grew up in orphanages and foster homes and managed to have me and guided, got her pregnant, disappeared. And so here I am growing up, first without a father, with my mother. And then I go into the world. I leave home at about 17, and I go into the world. And the first record company I meet up with is a record company called Rock Candy Records and Filmworks. Rock Candy Records and Filmworks. Well, of course, naive and young, you know, I walk right into it. Me and Scott, as a matter of fact, we signed a deal with these guys. They basically ripped us off, took everything we had, and we found out they were a pornography ring on top of that. And not that I'm criticizing that. I mean, it's a full industry. Pornography is how babies are made and all that. But damn, you could have told me that the desk that I'm doing phone calls in by day is the same desk you got this chick on at night. And it was crazy at B-Boy, well, Rock Candy Records, which I then renamed our label B-Boy Records. I drew the label by hand. And we started putting our records out there. But I mention this because the owners of the label were black men, Jack Allen, Ray Wilson, Bill Camara, black men. And here you have young black men, one fresh out of college, the other fresh off the streets. And you rip them off like this? I mean, now just jump from there. Now I go, oh, me and Scott, we go to Benny Medina, a black man, by the way. And we say, yo, get us out of this situation. He says, I got you. Then Scott gets killed, and he rescinds on the deal. So he feels he has to rescind on the deal. But then guess who picks me up? Barry Weiss. Now I'm at Jive Records. And it always struck me funny that, you know, back in the days, we were so desperate to get out of our situations, which is why many bad deals were made. But when I looked at the contract, it said Jive. Now, in African-American lingo, in African-American lexicon here, Jive means bullshit. It means not serious. You're jiving, man. This jive ass so-and-so. This jive turkey. Now, I'm looking at the contract. It says this is Jive. And so I signed it. And later learned that the company bears more resemblance to its name than you can possibly imagine. Jive really lived up to its name. And I say that respectfully because in actuality, I will also say that I could not be KRS-One if it was not for Jive. Jive Records is the foundation of my birth, the birth of my career. But that was some jive-ass shit, man. The whole, from the time I signed to Jive in 87 to the time I got off the label in 2002, when Koch bought out the Jive contract in 2002, you know, it's been one conflict after another, and I would never criticize Jive. Barry Weiss is a genius, and geniuses are complex people, and I mean that, too. He's a genius. And, right. I mean, he's really a brilliant man in what his world is about, but there's conflicts with that, especially when you're up against someone like me. I'm quite sure they respect me the same way. I was a pain in their ass when I was on Jive. No doubt. I know I was. But nonetheless, they see my work, and they saw what I did with the time I was there with them. They saw what my priorities were. And to this day, Jive respects totally what KRS-One is about. Absolutely. In fact, the Stop the Violence movement, I'm relying on a lot of their help to give me the files and paperwork and photographs of the old Stop the Violence movement, which was put out through Jive Records, by the way. But I'm going off. I mentioned a few things. But this starts my career. This is the actual start. It starts with me leaving home at about 17, 18, wandering the streets, finding, discovering myself, writing rhymes. I meet Scott Sterling, social worker at the shelter, about 1985. We link up, start Boogie Down Productions, get into a battle with MC Shan and Molly Mall, and go on to create Criminal Minded, well, South Bronx, Bridges Over, then Criminal Minded. Scott gets killed. We go to Warner Brothers, they rescind. Scott gets killed. I then go to Jive Records, and there, the rest is literally history then. I put out By All Means Necessary in my first video, My Philosophy, shot by Fab Five Freddy, which was his first video job, by the way. And so with Molly Mall, with the Hip Hop Lives project, Molly brings karma. Marley completes my karma with hip-hop and with him. I never like to have bad spirits linger. Me and Marley don't have bad spirits. Me and Shan don't have bad. Me and Shantae don't have bad spirits. But it hasn't been rectified in hip-hop's history what our stance with each other are. If you just read hip-hop's history or just go according to the beef DVDs, you would think that me and Molly and Shan still got beef to this day, still challenging one another. When in fact, when we were battling back then, there was no beef. Maybe right. There was 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, if it could have got serious. But really, about 2 months into the battle, we were trying to get money and do our careers at that point. But people don't know that. And we weren't too quick to propagate that because we were successful as who we were. You know, we were very successful as MC Shan, KRS, the battle. It was historic. It was classic. And I think everybody enjoyed their position. But there was a bad taste in everyone's mouth, including mine. Some of the things I said about Roxanne Shanté, you know, I said that at 22. Roxanne Shanté is only good for steady pumping. Oh, Lord. You know, I said that at 22. Today I'm 42. I feel like an idiot today. I don't speak like that. I would never address a woman in such a way at 42, even as an MC in battle. But back then, that's what it was, and that's the battle. And Shantae has been a sportswoman about it for 20 years, no doubt. But I wanted to make it clear, though, you know, that, you know, not only do I resent such stances, but if I can sort of change the course of them in history by actually doing collaborative work with those we've had conflict with, well, then let me get to it. I'm a man of peace. I try to hold myself out as a man of peace. And so this is one of the ways of causing and instigating peace is putting an album project out with Molly Mall producing, totally at the helms of the project. Plus, it's a celebration of our anniversary, 87 to 2007. 87 is when Criminal Minded came out. 2007, Hip Hop Lives. Many think that the title had a lot to do with Nas, Hip Hop is Dead. Although we knew that and didn't care, like, yeah, okay, sure, it'll be that. The real inspiration, if you notice, the album before Hip Hop Lives was an album called Life. And this is what I keep trying to inject into hip hop: life, and light, meaning awareness. Inject into hip-hop light and life. And the last album was Life. The next album was going to have something to do with life or living. Mm-hmm. And Nas drops Hip Hop is Dead. In addition to that, which is what really inspired me, was James Brown's death on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And that really was the talk. In the studio, when we were doing the album, I was like, man, hip-hop now lives. And now, we now know our divinity in that sense. We now actually have concrete evidence of the mystical applications of our culture. And this is an all-new study, but it's blatant. And I've been following it really the whole time I've been participating in hip-hop's culture. I've been looking at this, the mystical implications, the spiritual, philosophical, metaphysical implications of hip-hop. And James Brown, who, by the way, happens to be the father of hip-hop, that's who Kool Herc and Africa Bambaataa and Crazy Legs and Rocksteady and Grandmaster Flash, this is who they all are inspired by, James Brown. And it was James Brown who put the... I mean, James Brown is the origination of hip-hop, right there. For him to die on Christmas, on the birth of... He dies on the birth of the Christ. You know, I don't take things like that lightly. And I just add them into my long list of mystic hip-hop mystical experiences.
Real talk. Real talk.
What does it mean to be underground? It means you gotta be free to be underground. Yo, you got your own key when you're underground. If you're listening to me, yo, you underground. It's time that I open with a thunder sound. Now look around your own town for the underground. Yo, you rhyming for the TV or a million CDs? You ain't an MC, you ain't underground. You could be platinum or gold, hot or cold.
Real talk. Real talk.
I come back every year, I get newer. I'm the dust on the moon, I'm the trash in the sewer. Let's go. I come back every year, I get brighter. If you thinking hip hop is alive, hold up your lighter. Let's go. I come back every year, I'm expanding, talking to developers about the city we planning. Come on. I come back through any endeavor. This is hip hop, we gon' last forever. Hip
means to know. It's a form of intelligence. To be hip is to be update and relevant. Hop is a form of movement. You can't just observe a hop. You gotta hop up and do it. Hip and hop.
Real talk. Real talk.
And I'm gonna go back to something that you said is really important, and it kind of affects what's going on nowadays. You know, at least in hip hop culture, the respect of battling. You know, you and Molly, you know, when Juice Crew and BDP had the battles going back and forth, and I'm, you know, I remember you've had a many of battles. The one thing I will say, man, and I really enjoyed about that was that the response that goes on now, if I call somebody's name and say, I can get you creatively, the response can be heavily weighted. And you know what I mean.
Yep.
Now, here's the thing. Back then, the you know, as you watch sometimes when you see people on TV, you know, you see a killer who's been, you know, serial killer or rapist or whatever else. And every now and then the family will jump up and say, nah, don't put him to death. Let him live with it. That was the way we battled back in the day. If you dared to call my name, I bring you to the stage, I'll embarrass you, and you can walk around the city, man, and everybody and their mom will point to you and remember, I wrecked you last night. You know what I mean? You live with that. I don't want you going nowhere. I'm not going to come after you, you know, looking for you, trying to get all in your face. Nah, I want you to walk with that. I want you to be nervous, and I want you to step your game up, because creatively, I really want you to come back and challenge me and give me, you know, let's step the game up. You know, I used to, you know, mess around with production here and there, and I swear to you, man, every time I thought I was going to put out a 12-inch, Eric Sermon, Molly, somebody would put something out, man, make me pull my shit right back in the studio. Like, I got to step it up. You know what I mean? And that was good creative energy, though. What happened?
The fans of real MCs and DJs became MCs and DJs themselves. There was a time where it was special to be an MC, special to be a DJ, special to be a B-boy, special to be a graffiti writer or a beatboxer. These things were special. Special people did them. And when they did them, they had a certain dress. They had a certain language. They went to certain places. And it was a real culture, so to speak, community that was self-regenerative and self-creative. And when we expressed ourselves in the 80s, we have, well, let me give you the eras. We have what I call the Dark Age, which is 1961 to 1971. This is the age of Dr. King and Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael and, you know, the greats, mm-hmm. Medgar Evers, so on, mm-hmm. Black Man. 71 to 81 is the age of light, where hip-hop gains awareness. And that's the era of Kool Herc, Bam, Flash, Crazy Legs, everybody. We actually realize that we exist. 71 to 81, this is where all of what the foundation of hip-hop was to become is created. And this is where you have real, authentic people creating hip-hop. We refer to Herc, Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, Flash, and Crazy Legs as the icons, as pinnacles of this era. But remember, everybody was doing it. Everybody. The innovations, you know, hip-hop is not created by one person. It was always a mass movement. But 71 to 81 is the light age. We actually even got our power to play out in the parks from the street lights, from the public street lamps. We would knock out the base of the lamp and rewire the city power to power our turntables and speakers. Afrika Bambaataa was known for this. Flash was known for this. Kool Herc was known for this as well. That's the age of light. 81 to 91, you get what is called the golden age. That's all of us. 81 to 91, that's That's funky. That's everyone from everyone that appeared in the movie Wild Style and Beat Street. All of those artists, in addition to the everyone that Marley Marl produced, everyone that Russell Simmons and Def Jam produced, everyone that I produced, everyone that Native Tongue produced, just in this era, 81 to 91. We then influenced the West Coast. Most think it was through NWA, but it was really through Too Short, who was really the first one to mimic kind of, I don't want to say mimic, but he was kind of the one selling his tapes out the back seat of the car back in 87, 88. And we was hearing about it on the East Coast, a West Coast dude selling tapes out his car, spitting the raw to the streets out there. and this is what our first taste of West Coast was actually coming into view. But that now takes us into 91 to 2001, which is the Platinum Age. And in this age, we go from Golden Age to Platinum Age. In the Platinum Age, which is also nicknamed the Ice Age, because 91 to 2001, all creativity kind of stopped in a way, and it became about money. It became corporate. It became... bling bling was termed in this era. We do get Wu-Tang Clan. We do get Biggie. We do get a lot of creativity is happening, especially in 94. The era like 93 to 98, that 5-year period was ridiculous for hip hop. Like, absolutely ridiculous. But nonetheless, it was overshadowed by immense wealth. Everything that we did in 81 to 91, we now reap the rewards of in 91 to 2001. And we went from gold to platinum in that sense. Now you go from 2001 to 2011. This is the age we're in now, which is the information age. Around the world, this age is known as the information age. I would add it as the age of culture, the age where old cultures are dying and new cultures and civilizations are being born right before our eyes. And so we're in this age now, and this is the age where we realize the folly of our ways. With the Platinum Age, we now see the effects of, we've crashed the Benz in this age now. We've learned that the BMW isn't that good in the rain. we've had the children now. We've gotten our gold and our jewelry snatched off our neck now. We've done some jail time now. Our man is dead now. We understand that the TV life, that facade that we played from 91 to 2001, we're now realizing that was a facade, and we can't live our lives like that. This is reflected in a lot of the changes that are going on within hip-hop. Artists are stepping up all over. I mean, we could talk about that, but hip-hoppers in general are stepping up ridiculously, all into entertainment. No one's really talking about it, but hip-hop is calming its image down, and voluntarily. It's no one's censoring us. No one's, coming after us in that sense. But we live amongst the people, and the people themselves are saying, yo, you can't say something a little more than your girl and your car and your... You know, the people themselves are saying to rappers and producers and DJs and people, hey, we want more out of you. And we are noticing that the hip-hop part of the entertainment industry is responding to that. So I say all of this to say, when you say, what happened? Here's what happened, in my opinion. first you have these errors. Take a look at the errors. Each time a new error comes up, we die and are reborn again. And we die. The hip-hop of Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa is no longer on the earth. The hip-hop of Sugar Hill Gang and Funky Four plus, you know, and Treacherous Three and Cold Crush no longer exists. The Golden Age, My Age, Big Daddy Kane, Public Enemy, Queen Latifah, Heavy D, Salt and Pepper, no longer exists. Over. Platinum Age, Biggie, Puffy, Early Mary J, Hip Hop Reggae, Mad Lion, Shaggy, all that, Wu-Tang, all that, gone. Now we're in this age, and this age seems to be a union in a weird way between culture and corporate. It's sort of like we are gaining the balances that we've been asking for and screaming for the past 30 years. We're actually gaining it, and this is a part of the problem, or not even problem, I say part of the challenge with hip-hop today, especially hip-hop scholars, those who teach hip-hop or critique hip-hop or write about it. It's important that we don't keep fighting yesterday's battles when we've already won them. You know, it's important that we really do have a sight as to who we are actually today. History is extremely important. It's the roadmap. But we do have vision and intelligence. We could create any scenario we want to create if we believe that we can create it. And this turns to you know, the responsibility of certain people, because this is the other thing that happened, is money. Before I go into the money, let me put a period here on this thing and say that many of our greatest minds are still fighting 1970s battles. And I think this is one of the stagnations, really, in all groups of people. But let's just keep this to African Americans in general and hip hop in particular. We're still afraid of the FBI, for instance. When the FBI is more afraid of us today, they've been completely beat down. Like, completely. The CIA, same way. The relationship with the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, all these government agencies, the relationship that our parents and grandparents had with these agencies is not what it is today. Now, mind you, this is not to insinuate at all that these agencies are somehow chummy-chummy and on our side suddenly. Not at all. But what it does imply is, in fact, I'll say it in a story, going back to MC Shan and Marley Marl. We did Madison Square Garden together in the early, like 95, 96. We did Madison Square Garden together where we recreated the battle on stage. Crowd loved it. Afterwards, a dark-skinned brother comes up to me, long dreadlocks hair, comes up, hands me a Criminal Minded tape, and says, "Yo, man, sign my Criminal Minded for me." So I hit him off, and I'm wondering, like, why is he backstage with us here? So I think he's a journalist or a manager of somebody, you know. So I'm like, "Yo, so what's up, man? Who you here with? Who, like, you know?" So I'm ready him to tell me somebody I know, like, you know, "Yo, I'm here with Kid Capri." I'm like, "Oh, well, where?" You know, tell. So he like, "Yo, man, here's my card. Look at the card. VP of Marketing Northwestern or some long ass title with Coca-Cola at the bottom." Now in 95, I had to check my own prejudice. Because I envisioned Coca-Cola executives in 1995 to be all white men who didn't really care much but for the exploitation of my community. And I platformed that. I was one of those revolutionaries out there, straight up, down with the corporation. But then this brother comes up to me and says, yo, this is me. Whatever you want to do, man, to further this cause. His thing was, at the time, we were preserving hip-hop, which is why we even did the concert. It was tied into the radio. It was, it had to do with hip-hop history. It was all of that. And he said, yo, you know, if you really want to get this message out, please call me. I really want to, you know, I want to do something. So I gave him a ring. Long story short, it turned out to become the Sprite commercial, which the critics beat me over the head for. Oh, he's a sellout. He did this and that with Coca-Cola, blah, blah, blah. But at the end of the day, it opened up billions of dollars into the hip-hop community with those commercials. Nas did a dope one with mimicking the Wild Style movie with Double Trouble. I mean, they were just going all out, and we're spending millions of dollars to propagate our culture. I suddenly realized that things are not what we perceive. Things are what they are. And the closer we get to the truth, the better off we're all going to be. These corporations are ran by us. Let me tell you the challenge right now. This is the challenge. America is a fascist country, meaning when the corporations, when business runs the government, you have a fascist country. When business interests run the government, you have fascism, factories running the government. Today, this is what America is. And we are all, we fight against it, we talk against it, we rally and protest, but this is what it basically is. However, our generation is the corporation. It is the corporate structure. We, see, ignorance is so ridiculous. We are actually above the government in social influence, but we act like we're under the government because we're back in 1960 fighting against Lyndon B. Johnson, or in that case, we're still working with Lyndon B. Johnson in the 60s when we've already toppled this government in the corporate structure. This idea of police beating us over the head, that has more to do with our internal disorganization than it has to do with anything else. I don't think police are out to abuse African Americans. I don't agree with that. I think even if you're the most racist cop on the police force, there's still laws in this country, and your ass will get checked quick. The point of the matter is we're not obeying the law because we don't know the law. And the sad part to it is that we wrote the law. Damn. We wrote the law. You know, 29 signers of the Declaration of Independence were men of color.
Wow.
29 of the signers. I think it was 59 signers or something like 56 signers, something like that. 29 of them were men of color, meaning Native Americans and blacks.
Mm. Wow.
29. These were not slaves. These were free men that owned slaves, by the way. Sneak that in on you, too. Blacks owned slaves. Native Americans owned slaves, right along with whites who owned slaves. We signed that Declaration of Independence and then went on to fashion the Constitution as well. But our kids think that's their document, and proof that we wrote it is in hip-hop, because we're the only ones who naturally act out. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
Is hip-hop. Life, liberty, let me walk around free, don't be beating me over the head, and the pursuit of happiness, which is a very controversial statement, because who's to say sniffing coke is not my happiness? Who's to say the red light district in Germany is not my happiness? Who's to say standing on a bed of nails is not my happiness? And that's just a concept, but I appreciate our ancestors for putting that in there. We may be fighting battles that we already have conquered. And I bring that up in the idea of what happened, because what happened to hip-hop is that we really don't know who we are, just like African Americans don't know who they are. And notice how I said that. You know, we, hip-hop, new civilization on the earth, don't know who we are. And our parent civilization, say for me, it would be the African civilization as a parent civilization. Africans in America don't know who they are. And so, sure, there used to be a time where the music used to, wait a minute, there used to be a time where you listened to music. Today, we don't play music. We're not playing music anymore. We are reproducing music through computer technology. And if you can, like, we're all being judged on our proximity to the classics and original music. And, you know, artists are not today being critiqued on their music. Artists today are music merchants, not musicians. We are selling music. We are using music as a job to pay bills. We're not doing music and living homeless because it didn't sell. So what? We're on the street. No, we are using music as a commodity, as a product, as a tool. And this is where a lot of art, I would even say rappers, become stagnated.
Real talk. Real talk. This is just one
star. We back up in this piece like Easter bread. Underground, you gotta find me like an Easter egg. No need to beg, I hit the club hard on the reg. While you check for CDs, I'm selling books instead. I travel the country by car. And leg. What's worse than being behind is being ahead. Prophetic visions of President Jeb. Five storms hit Florida on his head and nobody said, what's the meaning of this? It's like God is dead. In the minds of the people hanging on to a thread. You gotta go where your heart is led. I spit truth but some cats, they just got the hardest head.
Real talk. Real talk.
Right now, ladies and gentlemen,
this is a rap session, and my name is R.S.T.O.N. And when I talk about hip-hop music, I know.
One, breaking or break dancing, really b-boying, freestyle street dancing. Two, MCing or rap, divine speech, what I'm doing right now, no act. Three, graffiti art or burning, bombing, tagging, writing, now you're learning. Four, DJing, we ain't playing. You know what I'm saying? Five, beatboxing, give me a
real talk. Real talk. Real talk.
What does Black History, and whether it be Black History Month or just Black History in general, what does that mean to you in your life?
Black history in and of itself, just the concept of Black history, I think is different from African American history. And I think it's different from African history. I think Black history is the history of a political group of people, as opposed to an ethnicity in particular. I know some Asians that are more Black than African Americans or would support the cause with more commitment than some African Americans. We found out in the 60s that color, race, should I say race, is not a criteria for revolutionary organization. Race can't be the criteria. It's too weak. Interest and commitment is at least the criteria that has been adopted over the last 20 years. Commitment. What is your commitment? What are you willing to put your time into? Where's your energy going? Where's your money going? Where's your study going? That thing has judged people's characters. But when it comes to Black history, first, I'll just make that distinction. The history of the political movement it's the history of the oppressed against oppression is Black history. The history of the oppressed against oppression. Now, whatever the oppressed means is part of Black history. Now, just go deeper in that, African American history. African Americans, if you relegate Black history to African American, it's like the way it's celebrated in the United States is that Black history is African American history. I would argue that Black history really is everyone's history, and or anyone who feels that they have to, and anyone who feels that they are part of the class of people that are struggling for their freedom and wealth, so on. Capitalism has a way of exploiting the resources of all the people in the world. And so Black history should be the history of that relationship with all the people in the world. Now, to African Americans, that would mean during Black History Month, African Americans link themselves to all the struggles of Black people in the world. I would argue that the Irish would be called Black people, looking at their fight against the British colonial commercialism for 850 years. I would argue that that's Black history right there, right along with, say, the Chinese that protested in Tiananmen Square. That's Black history right there. And African-American youth should know that and should get into that. Now, African-American history should be about, in my opinion, should be about the building of the African-American nation. It shouldn't really be about a celebration of the past. That should already be in your house. The ancestors that you respect should already be somewhere near you, in your home, in your workplace, wherever that is. We don't wait till 1 month to now think about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass or Malcolm X. I mean, that should be all year round. So let's just discard that idea real quick. You know, Mobile salutes Black History Month, and they tell you some self-esteem message about how great you are because you're African-American. To me, that's slight racist, if you ask me, in that sense. If we're saying that, you know, we want democracy and equality and justice before the law and equality before the law, really equality before the law and this, that, and the other, then why even have Black History Month? Because if you're going to have Black History Month, where's White History Month? You know, where's, and then it gets stupid, right? Red History Month, and then there's the colors again, and then that becomes ridiculous when we get to Yellow History Month. And maybe, well, maybe not. I mean, you know, we're crazy enough to go ahead and do something like that, Brown History Month. But I think it's a bit racist. And maybe racist is a harsh word, but if I was head of the NAACP, I would ask African Americans to consider broadening the view of Black History Month to include the struggles of all oppressed people, as opposed to just the history of African Americans.
And I'm gonna say this, Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I agree with your points that in African American households and in general, that's something that ought to be a regular, in my house it is, in my peers' homes, some it is, some it's not. But I think that, you know, the celebration of Black History Month, because of so much exclusion from American history, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that you can't find it, but, you know, when you think about public school systems, and you think back to, you know, what you may have learned in public school systems. I mean, if you look at like Dr. Cornel West's history, you know, he had to actually protest in his school to get them to include African-American studies.
That's right.
To learn, you know what I mean? So the Black History Month celebration was brought on to, you know, and I know you know that, but to you know, to recognize to the world, to say to the world, we're going to point out the things that you should have already recognized about us. You agree with that, or is that, am I, because I understand
no,
your point.
No, you're absolutely correct. But are we about only our past, or can we introduce ourselves, can we reintroduce ourselves to the world every year during February? Yes, I'm not in any way advocating that we should not celebrate Black History Month, but American history, American history, will fall by itself because it's not the truth. There is so much that is not in standard American history
right.
that it, by itself, is beginning to look ridiculous by itself. I see African Americans walking the same path with African American history. And we do have some time to correct it. It doesn't have to be this way. The way we treat Black History Month, you know, we're not approaching it as, with scholarship. We're trying to get corporate dollars. You know, like, I'm talking about African-American leadership, if there is such a group. It's trying to get money, basically, from the guilt of white corporate America. You know, we hear of mobile buying commercials. We hear of Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's and even Coca-Cola and these people trying to do their thing. And keep and remember what I said previously. This is Black people, okay, at Kentucky Fried Chicken, top executives, and can't figure out what to do during Black History Month. You know, GM does something every year for Black. I'm quite sure they have consulted with Black America. What do we need to do? Black America don't know what to do. So because we don't have an agenda unto ourselves, we get lumped into the American Foundation, the American Educational Foundation, which is basically, let's just celebrate the greatness of conquered people. You were great. Look what you were before the white man came. And you know, and this is blatant. I mean, there's movies now, and, you know, it's blatant. Like, the white man is now accepting. And I think this is terrible for white youth that they've accepted now their role as the world's oppressors. They've now accepted, and not accepted like they themselves are accepting it, but like it's like when like it's acceptable to say white devil. Like, I was watching, I think, Ace Ventura something the other night. It was Jim Carrey, and it was comedy, and he's the genius, and it was dope. But white devil was the joke. He was amongst some Africans. And the Africans was like, you white devil, we're going to kill you. Like, you know, and it was funny. It was ridiculously funny. But in this context, in this conversation here, white men, especially white men, have relegated themselves to being devils, to being mean, to being gangsters, to being, you know, unlawful. And I think it's almost the responsibility of African Americans to make sure that the white household and family does not fall apart. Yeah, we got our own problems. You know that's real, and we must deal with that. But I believe that one way of dealing with your own house is by really serving the well-being of another house. It's a weird thing where I know you're supposed to put your mask on first and then attend to your child, but that's if you're dealing with dependency. Your child is dependent upon you, so therefore get your act together first, and therefore you'll be able to take care of the child. But in a sense of racial dignity, just I consider myself the ultimate black man, straight up. I mean, and seriously, to myself, I consider myself the ultimate black man. Now, what does that mean? That means that, and I live in a white neighborhood too, by the way, white and Mexican and Asian, right here in L.A. I live. And the white kids that mingle with my kids, I got to smack them up every once in a while. No, you don't do that here. You know, no, that don't go down here. And they respect it, and they move on. Yo, that's Mr. Parker. Okay, he's not having that. You know, so-and-so. Yo, he wants his kid in at a certain hour. He's calling my moms. Because, you know, I know all these kids' parents on my block. I know everybody's parents here. And, you know, I'll call them up. You know your kid's over here? I told Johnny to call me. And he not even Johnny. I told Micah to call me. This is one of my children's friends. To call me, and he didn't. Well, parents got to have a network and a communication that takes care of another family's child. It don't matter whether you black, white, Native American, Asian, whatever it is. Who are you? You know, where's the ultimate white man that can take care of my children or me or my wife or whatever better than I can? Or dispense justice better than me? This is a controversial statement I'm making here as well, because this points to supremacy, true supremacy. You know, in America, we got it twisted where we say white supremacy is equated with one race over another, when in fact, or the white race over other races. White supremacy, the betterness of the white race over other races. That's not what supremacy means, though. Supremacy means perfection. It means, you know, complete high conduct, high honor, supreme, you know, the pinnacle of, the zenith of, in that sense. That's what's supreme. So how does lynching become supreme? How is that white supremacy when we say, you know, he was lynched, white supremacists lynched a black man, or white supremacists don't want blacks to, you know, do this or go here or be there. That's not a white supremacist. Because there's nothing supreme about hate. There's nothing supreme about that. A white supremacist is more or less the people I live around right here on my block. People I can trust my kids with. That's a white supremacist. That's the ultimate white man or woman that takes my black kid into her house and feeds him and clothes him. And if he got a cut, put a Band-Aid on his hand and don't even think about his race or his class or whatever it is. That's supreme.